Okay, David, did you want to say something at this intermission here? If so, stick your hand up. Otherwise, welcome everybody to our Sunday afternoon slot, where our focus is on the earliest written record of A Course in Miracles, which is found in two collections of Helen Schuckman's manuscripts, her original shorthand notes and her later edited transcript known as the Urtext. Well, there can be an intermission, and sometimes David likes to come in and announce what's coming up later. I guess people can hear me. I didn't ask if you could. Okay. Now, what I've been doing for the past few months is going through the shorthand notes and identifying material which did not make it into the Urtext version, and combining these two earliest and most original versions of the Course. The resulting document, therefore, is not any one of the five known scribal versions, but rather a combination of these two earliest ones. It includes essentially all of what could be considered the original dictation for which we have any documentary record. This material does have some rough spots, some segments which were written down only in point form, and some sentences which were never completed. In that sense, it certainly does need some editing in places, and it's not really a finished product at spots. The notes also include some material specifically labeled as a private point and not part of the Course. In fact, today's reading we're going to start off with material that's just that. This includes conversations between Helen and Jesus about topics of concern to Helen at the time. While not part of the Course proper, these outtakes, if you will, provide considerable insight into Helen's experience and often involve explanations of miracle principles, practical examples from Helen's own life, and as such, expand our understanding of both the Course proper and her scribing experience, which resulted in what we know today as A Course in Miracles. So what we're doing today will be reading some commentary and discussion of this material. And a copy of this is available on the net at, where did I put it? Where did I hide it? I'm going to post the URL here. And for those on the radio who can't see what I'm posting, if you go to www.miraclesinactionpress.com/DTOMP74, in the top on the top of the left hand navigation page, click on original dictation text 1-8. That's the link title, and it'll bring you to that document. Now, the basic format we're using in this slot is reading and commentary plus some discussion. There tends to be more commentary and discussion than reading. We're getting through just a few pages a week in a 2-hour slot. So while I'd encourage everyone to raise your hand if you have something to share, I'd appreciate it if you try to keep your comments fairly brief and to the point. Try to keep it under 3 minutes unless something truly exceptional arises. Deborah will be keeping an eye on the hands on the board, and she is like the chairperson here. When she acknowledges your hand and drops the mic, then you can take the mic. And if, when you have the mic, either Deborah or I raise our hands, please conclude your remarks and drop it. And on that note, I'm going to pass the mic to Deborah.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. I don't know exactly where this is going to be taking me today, because as I was entering Pell Talk, I clicked on education and I was promptly directed into Beer Drinkers and Hellraiser's room. So I don't know if that's some kind of message to me to be a Hellraiser or definitely not a beer drinker. I'll just start in here. Doug Thompson, I really want to thank you for all the work that you have done with this material. It's just wonderful, and it really brings us to the most accurate information that we can get our hands on to see what Jesus really did pass on through Helen. is the way I see that, and I'm really appreciative to you for that. And thanks, Dove, for having Gather available for this to even take to be taking place. So I guess what I'll do is just have us all come together as we sit here in this healing context. I ask that we let go of any outer distractions and come together with inner guidance from Jesus and Holy Spirit. So just letting everything go and being here present. Help me to perform whatever miracles you want of me today, and Lord, heal me. So I will, Doug continues to, Lee, as you put here, Doug has worked tirelessly for many years. It's truly amazing. So I'm going to begin reading at T1B16A-N1. So this is notes. All N stands for notes. Regarding Wally's chalice, does this mean he is on my list? Not necessarily. N2. Not necessarily. Only that you of all people should know that it frightens people if you hand them back their own chalice. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, thanks. I just wanted to introduce this particular segment a bit. First of all, for people who are trying to find it on the online copy, I'm going to... Okay, did you hear anything there? Probably not. I didn't pick up the mic. Okay, I just wanted to introduce this material. First of all, for people who are looking for the spot in the online copy, it's not actually indexed. Oh, you did. Okay. But if you do your Control F in your browser and type in actually 16A-N1, it'll pop up instantly. We're still in the first section, the introductory section. Otherwise you can search for the word chalice. Because it's the first instance of that word in this document. And what we finished with last week was, by and large, Urtext material with a little bit of notes stuck in. And what we're starting with right now is material that didn't make it into the Urtext. It's entirely, or substantially, material from the notes, which was omitted. And it has some very interesting comments. Some of it is largely inexplicable to me. I don't really know I don't know the background in Helen's life that this material is relating to. There's a couple of places here where it looks to me that we have a miracle principle that was dictated and should have been included. But as Helen bounced back and forth, sometimes line by line, between taking dictation and then asking Jesus questions, some of that stuff got missed, I believe. And we'll be coming across some of it today. So we have a rather long segment here that is entirely from the notes. It's not part of the Urtext. It didn't make it into any other version. And it gives us some idea of what Helen and Jesus were talking about, some of the issues she was dealing with. And in some cases, some lines that look like maybe they should have been included. Is there going to be a supplement book for those who bought the Urtext? I don't know. We did the HLC first, and then we did the Urtext. And now we're working on the notes, and basically what we have here in the online copy is the notes. And where the type is regular type, it's material that's included in the Urtext. And with only a few exceptions, the material is 99% the same. And so what I have done is, where the material is different, where the notes has something different, significantly different, other than a little spelling change or something, from the Urtext, I put it in bold type to indicate the notes reading is different, and wherever it needs an explanation, I footnoted it. The vast bulk of the notes material that differs from the Urtext is in the first few chapters. There's a little bit all the way through, but a very little bit. And I don't know I can't quite answer. No, and anyways, and to answer your question, no plans have been made in that regard. I haven't even thought about that. So, anyway, that's what this is. So where Deborah's starting is in this section about Wally's chalice, and I'll start off right off the bat by saying I don't know what Wally's chalice is. She uses the word chalice several times in this chapter. I presume it is some kind of sacramental reference to the Holy Grail, which in tradition is the cup Jesus used at the Last Supper, and generally symbolizes a receptacle of something holy, a container for something sacred. But I don't know what Wally's container for the sacred means. I don't know what Jesus means when he says later on, very, very briefly later on, we're going to come across it. He tells Helen that you of all people should know that it frightens people if you hand them back their own chalice. I simply do not know what that is talking about. And if anybody does or has an idea, throw your hand up. I'm all ears. Okay, so with that introduction to this segment, I'm not sure how long it's going to take us. Away we go. T1B16AN1. And for those on the radio, www.miraclesinactionpress.com. DTHOMP74. And click on the link that says original dictation on the top left corner. For those online, I'll post the link once more after I hand the mic back to Deborah.
Okay, so I'm starting fresh again at the same place, T1B16N1. Regarding Wally's chalice, does this mean he is on my list? N2, not necessarily. Only that you of all people should know that it frightens people if you hand them back their own chalice. N3, whether he is or not depends on a three-way readiness. I am always ready. Your job is to take care of your readiness. His readiness is up to him. N4. At present, he is a potential candidate, but Amy is on it now. N5. She is a child you hurt. The whole problem is that they threw it away and are denying it. Therefore, they are now afraid of it. This should cause you no trouble at all in understanding. You both have an identification problem which makes you unstable, but in different ways. He lacks confidence in his identification and needs to strengthen it. You vacillate in your identification and need better control. Here's the mic, Doug.
Okay, we have another sort of mystery comment here. Does this mean he's on my list? What list? Not necessarily. Whether he is or not depends on this three-way readiness. Jesus is saying he's always ready. Your job, Helen, is to take care of your readiness. His, Wally's readiness is up to him. Which suggests the list here. Also, Amy is on it. And then this description of some past life, apparently, connection with Amy, suggests it's a list of people that Jesus is bringing to Helen's attention that he wants to do some work with her, a three-way readiness. He's ready, he wants Helen to be ready, and the readiness of the other is up to that other. That's what it suggests to me, but I do not know. I have no independent information about what that list is. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about that one. And if anybody has any inspirations or proddings from the Holy Spirit on what that might be about, by all means raise your hand. I'm all ears. Here's the mic, Deb.
N6, T1B16A-N6. Both of you needn't worry. N7, you must love the children and help them. You have hated them and hurt them. But remember, Azra, that you once loved them very much. You were a child of light. Forget the interval of darkness and be what you were. That is your real self. Doug.
Okay, here we come up with another sort of mystery, the name Azra, which is used several times by Jesus, apparently addressing Helen. In Arabic, that name means maiden, but its origins appear to be Hebrew, where its meaning is pure. And you're going to find this interesting, Anne. Some sources suggest it's a form of Ezra or Azrael. It would... there's many conjectures about what that might be, that it is a name perhaps Helen went by in a previous lifetime, and that what we're talking about here is something that happened in a previous lifetime. In fact, a couple of things get talked about in that context. Amy, which we just read about, apparently is somebody that might be. There's several ways of reading that line. Might be some referred to a past life relationship which has recurred in Helen's contemporary life. But beyond that, I don't really know what this particular significance of Azra is. It may just be Helen's habit of using pseudonyms to refer to people. She calls her husband Louis by the name Jonathan. She may be calling herself by the name Azra. That's another possible explanation of the use of that name. I don't know. Okay, Deborah, back to you.
I'm intrigued with Jesus referring to past tense here. You were a child of light. Forget the interval of darkness and be what you were, rather than directly saying to her, you are a child of light. I find that pretty intriguing. Here's the mic, Dove. Wow, you got three names there.
You're developing Helen's habit of pseudepigraphy. All right. The past tense also suggests, it doesn't insist on the interpretation, that what we're talking about is something from a past life rather than maybe something last year. You were once a child of light. From what we know of Helen's biography, there's not a lot in there that would suggest it was something that happened a few years ago. But the whole context here does give us the suggestion that there's a reference that's being made to a previous incarnation. And again, it's a suggestion. It's not specifically laid out. There may well be other interpretations of what that's about. And again, I have no independent information to confirm it one way or another. All right, Deborah.
T1B16A-N8. Chip's story triggered the abandonment of the child or of the children, guilt and a fear of God's abandonment of justice. I told you I forgave you, and that meant all hurt and hate you have ever experienced is canceled. I need the children of light now, and I am calling you to be what you once were and must be again. N9. The interval has vanished without a trace anywhere. You who live so close to God must not give way to guilt. N10. The karmic law demands abandonment for abandoning, but you have received mercy, not justice. N11. Help the children because you love them and love God. Here's the mic, Doug.
Okay, well, we have more of this past tense material. And we have an introduction of the idea of, in N8, Chip's story triggered the abandonment of the children. That was a dream we read last week, that Helen had had a dream which involved children and animals being abandoned. And I think this is dream interpretation here, with guilt and a fear of God's abandonment as justice. So if she felt guilty of abandoning at the ego level, the ego would say, well, I deserve to be abandoned by God. That would be my just reward. And now we're getting in N10, the karmic law demands abandonment for abandoning, but you have received mercy, not ego justice, not tit for tat, not an eye for an eye. And in between there, the emphasis on forgiveness. I told you that I forgave you, and that meant all hurt and hate you have ever experienced is canceled. And even in most karmic theories, there is the idea that forgiveness, genuine forgiveness, cancels karma. Whatever karmic debt might be earned from a mistake or hurting someone, for instance, is canceled by genuine forgiveness. And this idea will be expanded upon, as most of you know, vastly in the rest of the course. It's an early introduction of that concept. Help the children because you love them and love God at the end of N11. And in N12, we seem to step out of the conversation about the abandonment and karma, and we seem to have what I think is a miracle principle stuck right in the middle of it. I think that Helen is bouncing back and forth between taking dictation and having this conversation with Jesus about her dream interpretation. And I'm just going to read this one, Deborah, since I'm here on it. Remember, a miracle is a spark of life. It shines through the darkness and brings in the light. You must begin to forget and remember. And that takes the form of many miracle principles. The definition, a miracle is something, and then a description of what that something is, and then a conclusion, what you must do about it. And this particular three sentences didn't make it into any subsequent version, and I think this would, in my view, this qualifies as a candidate for an inadvertent omission. The dream interpretation clearly was never intended to be part of the course. That's something between Jesus and Helen. And in the next line, we read, this is a private point just for you. This is not part of the course. So we know that what follows isn't. But this one paragraph here, 16a and 12, I regard as a miracle principle. It's a spark of life. It shines through the darkness and brings in the light. You must begin to forget and remember. Which is really interesting, because as we see in the structure of the workbook, the initial lessons are telling us to unlearn, and then we're introduced with new learning. So we're basically being told to forget everything you know, or think you know, and remember what you really know at the soul level. And that pedagogical structure, which is so typical of so much of the course, again makes me think that these three sentences were intended to be part of the course and not merely a private point for Helen, combined with the fact that in the next breath he's saying, this is a private point, it's not part of the course, which implies that what immediately preceded it was part of the course. Okay, so this is a private point just for you, it's not part of the course. That's N13. So we could pick up here, Deborah, at T1B, 16A, N14, the private point.
Oh, it looked like my mic wasn't picking up here. Is it on? It dropped and then... Okay. It was a magical mic. I wanted to address N12 myself. I'm really happy to be reading this three lines because of what's been going on with me lately. I've been going through humongous shifts, and it's been a shift into shifting happening in my mind more so than in my body, which I've relied on previously, or my emotional state. But now it seems to be going so much clearer through my mind. So this week I really buckled and became quite blocked and ended up in bed for 2 days. And then on the morning of the second day, I woke up and went, oh my God, I feel like crap. I don't think I can get out of bed yet. This is absolutely crazy. I had no energy. I was completely feeling exhausted inside, and I had this huge block sitting in my belly area, or between my lower abdomen and belly. I used the body to define that, although I couldn't feel it in tissues. If I touched my belly, it didn't hurt, or my belly wasn't aching, but I had the sense of it being in that area. That's why I define it that way. So I was laying there, and I did forgiveness, I did the course principles, and then handing things over, whatever was going on, and I didn't know what was going on. And then the thought came in, do a chakra alignment. I hadn't done one of those in a long time. So that's something I use my two hands with on my body and go down my chakra system and let it shift. And as I did that, suddenly in my mind, when I got past my down as far as my throat, I guess. Suddenly, in my mind, the light came, bam, these areas where there was globs of light shining through, and I went, wow, I didn't even know that it was darkish in there. There was sort of a medium gray color, and this light was just blasting through in different areas. And then as I carried on through, that was really potent for me in that moment. And to me, it's like that miracle happening that I'm spotting with this miracle number 12, where it's saying that the light, the spark of life, the light shines through the darkness and it brings in light. So as I got down to where the block was, I thought, wow, this just feels so stuck. Like it's really there. And then suddenly it started to disperse and dissipate, and I was just amazed at what was going on, and it cleared. And by the time I was completed the chakra alignment, I had full energy come back in, and I got up and was up and energized for the day. So to me, it just fits so nicely with this number 12 here. So I'll go on to listen. Yeah, okay, Doug, go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering, Deborah, if there was anything psychological to which you could connect, or with which you identify that physiological response of something in your gut and complete exhaustion that required unusual amounts of sleep. Was there some issue you were dealing with, or that you could identify?
Actually, there was a few issues, Doug, and I can't pin it to anyone. There was issues with in Gather. There was issues with my eating. There was issues of doing round-the-clock work. Everything coming together was just sort of, I think, forming. And I don't know how that works with my mind and that all coming together, but it all just seemed to be all together. I can't separate one from the other as saying, oh, this is the thing that occurred and made that happen. It just seems like everything together. But I know that when I thought of certain things, I would just feel so nauseous, and then which I'm not willing to share right now. So that's as much as I can go in there. Any more questions? generally stressed and anxious about several things all at once. Yeah, I think so. That's about it. And I was really pushing it with putting things into my body that aren't really good for me, and really amazed that they weren't affecting me as much as I thought they would be affecting me, and some things not at all, and then bam, crash. It was just everything together. So I'll go on reading unless I see a hand. So, and let's see. And 14, I guess that's where we're starting. Sagar has just joined the room, so I want to post the URL here for you and where we're starting. It's just changing it so I can copy and paste it. Here we go. Okay, Doug, you've got the first part. I'll just paste the whole. Oh, there we go. Kate just came. Oh, Kate just left. Okay. So N14, a miracle is love. You always wanted presents, and a closed package was intolerable. Please open this one. You act like it's a time bomb. When I said a miracle abolishes time, you might look back and review the point in brackets. You're afraid there won't be enough time for you. Forget it and remember that there is no real difference between an instant and eternity. N15. I have healed the children you hurt before, but I have some I need your help with, or help in healing now. Here, Doug.
Okay, I just wanted to explain that the part in brackets refers to T1B15. Time is a teaching device and a means to an end. It will cease when it's no longer useful for facilitating learning. I believe that is what that's what follows the miracle abolishes time, and Jesus is telling Helen that she might look back and review that point. You're afraid there won't be enough time for you. Forget it and remember that there is no real difference between an instant and eternity. And then, moving on, I have healed the children you hurt before, which we were talking about earlier, but I have some need, I need your help in healing now. And that may refer to the list, that there's specific people Jesus, I believe, was drawing Helen's attention to as people she could help with his help. That's my guess as to what that one refers to. And that brings us to T1B 16A and 16. Here you go, Deb.
It's another instance where it's pointed that we can help others, that there are others we can help. It's not just us solo here projecting everything out there. There are others that we can help. N16, remember that there is no order in miracles because they are always maximal expressions of love. You did make a maximal effort for Chip, and the only reason you did it was because you loved Bill. N17, you might tell him to think about that sometimes because he does need signs of love, but he doesn't always recognize them because he does not have enough confidence. You particularly gave up your life for him quite voluntarily, but you did not know then that what you were really giving up was death. This is what in dying you live really means. And I said myself that greater love than this no man hath. Well, N18, Doug, here's the mic.
Yeah, there's a couple of magnificent references there. First of all, there's a reference back to Order of Miracles in N16, which is the first miracle principle. And Jesus is pointing out to Helen that she did make a maximum effort for Chip. And I'm not sure what that was about, but that was someone she was dealing with. And the only reason you did it was because you love Bill. And I also don't know what incident is referred to when Jesus says you practically gave up your life for him, Bill, quite voluntarily. But you didn't know then that what you were giving up was death. This is what "in dying you live" really means. And then this line, "as I said myself, and I said myself, that greater love than this no man hath," which is a reference to John 15:13, "greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." So there is this notion of dying to self, or dying to ego, or dying to selfishness, in terms, and as anyone who has ever loved anyone knows, and I think particularly parents know it, a parent's love for a child would lead him or her to, without hesitation, risk his own life to save his kid, or her kid, as the case may be. And in that, what we're being told here, and what Jesus is reminding Helen of, is in that selfless loving, you're not giving up your life, really. What you're giving up is death. Because what comes out of the pure exchange of love is the miracle of healing. All right. And Helen has quite a reaction to this, as we'll read in N18. So picking up at T1B16A N18, Deborah.
N18, "stop crying or you won't be fit to live now. Don't worry about Susie. You are helping Chip's readiness, and he did better than you with this one. This is unfair to you. Remember what you told him about Bobby? Chip is almost ready." N19, "review your note from yesterday that your identification is strong but erratic, and that is why you have so much willpower but use it wrong at times. Bill was right about the incredible misuse of it when you were sick, and it was a sign of superhuman will totally misdirected. Your body does not need it, but your spirit does, and I need it too. T1B16B. Instructions." So we're out of the notes material, we're into the ear text. "Instructions. The purpose of this course is integration. I told you that you will not be able to use it right until you have taken it. As long as your identification vacillates and Bill's is weak, you cannot accept the gift that belongs to you. You are still vacillating between recognizing the gift and throwing it away. Bill regards himself as too weak to accept it. You do not yet know its healing power. After you have passed the course, you will accept it and keep it and use it. That is the final exam, which you will have no trouble in passing. Midterm marks are not entered in the permanent record." Here's the mic, Doug.
Okay. There's a couple of references here that leave me scratching my head a bit. I'm not entirely sure what the gift is, this use of the word gift, but I think it refers to the course. And Helen's regarding it as a time bomb, as we just read, and vacillating between recognizing the gift, the course, and the conversation with Jesus, and throwing it away. Bill regards himself as too weak to accept it, but neither of you know its healing power, and after you have passed the course, you will accept it and keep it and use it. Lee writes, "the word incredible is not in the notes." The word incredible, I don't see the word incredible. Let me look for it here. Incredible. Incredible misuse of it when you were sick. Bill was right about that incredible misuse of it when you were sick. Ha. Huh. Okay, well, thanks for that, Lee. I will check that out. Okay, so that takes us to the end of T1B16B. Yeah, it could be that the Incredible was stuck in the Earth. No, it's not in the Earth text. Okay, I'm not sure where that came from or what's going on there. I'll have to look into it. But thank you, Lee, for your information there. That's that's the kind of proofreading we need. It appears and it was crossed out. Okay. That explains it, because crossed out words, I initially stuck them in with a strikeout font, and somewhere along the line, somehow I inadvertently removed all the strikeouts, and then I went through it, and I thought I had removed them all, but I guess that one slipped through that proofing phase. So Incredible should be deleted or indicated with a strikeout font. Okay. That would be the explanation of what happened on that line. Okay, folks, sorry for that diversion there. Yeah, the process of actually constructing this document has literally taken years and involves a great deal of complexity and proofreading, and occasionally errors are introduced by myself inadvertently, which then need to be found doing things like this. Okay. Midterm marks are not entered in the permanent record, which is another way in which Jesus is reassuring Helen that uncertainty or hesitations or mistakes do not have a permanent lasting effect. They're temporary in nature. And Helen responds to that. I'm going to read the next line here, Deborah. I really slipped, yet believed the latter thought. So she's noting that she had slipped, and yet she accepted or believed the essential forgiving nature of that. Now we're back, that's from the notes, that's not in the Ur text, that last line, which takes us to, back to Ur text material, T1B17, and here's the microphone, Deborah.
17, miracles are the absence of the body. They are sudden shifts into invisibility, away from the lower order reality. That is why they heal. And the experience that I explained that happened yesterday, to me, that whole, I'm using the body as a tool. I have my hands on my body. I'm going into the energy of the body. I'm letting go. I'm just letting go. So my body is no longer, I'm not laying there thinking body. I'm just laying there and letting my mind release, and whatever comes up, letting that release, and whatever comes into vision, letting that happen. So that just reinforces the body as a tool and how we can actually use it in healing processes. Just wanted to throw that in there. 18a, a miracle is a service. It is the maximal service that one soul can render another. It is a way of loving your neighbor as yourself. The doer recognizes his own and his neighbor's inestimable value simultaneously. 18b. This is why no areas of hatred can be retained. If you retain them, your own value is no longer inestimable, because you are evaluating it as X, or infinity, minus that amount. This is meaningless mathematically, which uses the term inestimable only in the very literal sense, pun intended, especially for Bill, who originally did not get it, intended as a special sign of love. Here you go, Doug.
Oh, there's a bunch of things in here. This is why no areas of hatred can be retained. If you retain them, your own value is no longer inestimable, because you are evaluating it as something minus that amount. Now, I think that we've got a punny way of expressing this, that Jesus is using targeted at Bill here, or possibly Helen and Bill both. But later on we read that as you view your brother, you view yourself. And this is a theme stated repeatedly and repeatedly and repeatedly in various different ways throughout the course, that a negative evaluation of someone else implies that you have evaluated yourself negatively. And so this is why no areas of hatred can be retained, because if you retain hatred of somebody else, then you're hating yourself. Your own value is whatever it is less the hatred you think you're projecting on someone else, because you're really actually believing it about yourself, or you wouldn't be projecting it on someone else. PDF Lee, everything's on PDF. Which PDF? Anyways, I've written down the what you wrote there, I think, on those two. Okay, so he doesn't really, but he thinks so. Okay, this is T1B, 18B, and 1. We're back into the shorthand notes material that was not preserved in the ear text. And this refers to Bill requiring special signs of love, which is a whole issue that is dealt with extensively in this part of the material, of Bill's uncertainty and needing reassurance, and Jesus going out of his way to provide it in various ways, with private jokes and gestures of affection. And now he's saying that he doesn't really need it, but he does think so. And now we get into an exceptionally interesting segment, which I'm not even going to comment on. Let's just read it. T1B, 18B, and 2. And take it away, Deborah.
And 2. Now tell him that homosexuality is sinful only to the extent that it is based on the principle of exclusion. Everybody should love everybody. And 3. It is wrong to deny the beauty of some souls because of body structures of which you are afraid. This is essentially an unhealthy attempt to limit fear. But fear cannot be limited, just as love cannot have limits. Wow. Fear cannot be limited, just as love cannot have limits. N4. Heterosexual attitudes can be similarly distorted, but do contain a more natural potential. Sex relations are intended for children. You and Bill have misunderstood sex because you both recognize it as a way of establishing human contact for yourselves. This has led to body image problems. Here's the mic, Doug.
All right. I had trouble picking it up there. There's so much stuff here. That one line I wanted to comment on, fear cannot be limited, just as love cannot have limits. It's like the analogy I've used before is, it's like pregnancy cannot be limited. You're either pregnant or you're not. You can't be a little bit pregnant. You're either afraid or you're not. You can't be a little bit afraid. You can think you're a little bit afraid, but really, you're either afraid or you're not afraid. And this is why, this is what I believe Jesus is trying to explain here, that the attempt to deny the beauty of some souls because of body structures of which you are afraid is an unhealthy attempt to limit fear, unhealthy and ultimately unsuccessful, because you can't really limit the fear. You could go into denial about it, but denial doesn't remove it. The second paragraph here, I'm going to read again because I think it is crucially important and deserves rereading and careful attention. Heterosexual attitudes can be similarly distorted, but do contain a more natural potential. Sex relations are intended for children. You and Bill have misunderstood sex because you both recognize it as a way of establishing human contact for yourselves. This has led to body image problems. And while he's addressing Helen and Bill here, I think he's probably addressing a majority of the human race who have misunderstood sex and recognize it as a way of establishing human contact for ourselves, which leads us into body image problems. Okay. On to T1B, 18B, N5. Deborah.
N5, children are miracles in their own right. They already have the gift of life, and their parents provide them with the opportunity to express it. N6, nothing physical, mental, or spiritual should be used selfishly. The pleasure from using anything should come from utilizing it for God's will. N7, you should live so that God is free to arrange temporarily human constellations as he sees fit. N8. Do not interrupt this in terms of guilt. Many children who are already here need spiritual parents. The poor are always with us, and many who are born have not been reborn. The poor are always with us. I need some clarification on there. I don't know if it means exactly literal that I am taking it as or not. What do you think?
The poor are always with us is, I was just trying to do something else here. Let me just find it. Poor are always with us. Okay. Come on, computer, behave yourself. This refers to a comment, I believe this could refer to a comment Jesus made or is reported to have made in the New Testament when Judas was telling him that the woman who had anointed his feet with expensive oil should be chastised because the oil could have been sold and the money given to the poor. And Jesus replies, "For ye have the poor always with you, and whenever ye will, ye can do them good, but ye have not always, but me ye have not always." That is the King James Version, of course. So the poor are always with you, and whenever you want, you can help them, but I'm not going to always be with you. So he's saying what she did was meritorious. So the poor are always with us. In other words, there will always be people in need, and many who are born, many people alive today, have not been reborn, which also refers, I believe, to the New Testament idea of you must be born again. You've been born in the flesh, you're here, but you must be reborn in the spirit. And in terms of the parenting and children idea, Jesus is also, I believe, here drawing attention to the idea that he's not necessarily entirely only talking about physical birth, but many children who are already here, many people who are already here, need spiritual parents. They need spiritual nurturing that they're not getting currently, and Bill and Helen are being called upon to be available to provide that, and by extension, we're being called upon to be available to provide that. That's how I understand that one. If anybody else has any comments, by all means, raise your hand.
Okay, thanks, Doug. N9. Human birth, maturation, and development is a microcosmic representation of a much larger process of creation and development of abilities. It is subject to error as long as the real purpose of free will is misunderstood and misdirected. N10, the real function of parents is to be wiser than the children in this respect and to teach them accordingly. In brackets, this upsets me. Sometimes I can get through anyway. I'll try, but I think I'm getting sick. Get that dream and give it to Bill today. He will see its relevance. N11, Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, here again we have one of the one of Helen's note-taking episodes in which she's basically setting things down in point form. And we alternate between Helen's comments and Jesus' answer. So Jesus is explaining the real function of parents is to be wiser than the children in this respect and to teach them accordingly. And that's the respect of the development of abilities. And then Helen's writing, this upsets me. And I believe the next comment, sometimes I can get through anyway, is from Jesus and refers to the fact that even when Helen is not in an ideal frame of mind, he can sometimes get through, and he often tries. So I think she's basically telling him, I'm upset enough right now that I don't think I can continue. And he's saying, sometimes I can get through anyway, I'll try. And then Helen says, but I think I'm getting sick. And Jesus says, get that dream and give it to Bill today. He will see its relevance. And goes on. That's how I'm interpreting that segment. That's what I think is going on there in the transaction, but it's not entirely clear, and I could certainly be mistaken. Helen goes on to say, discuss Giovanni, which I believe was a physician who was administering flu vaccine, including the flu shot, and be sure to tell him, here we get into Jesus' reassurance of Bill with Bill's special needs for signs of love. Be sure to tell him I did kiss him on the forehead and am kissing him now again. He is doing very well and I am deeply grateful for his efforts. I do need his help with this course. Okay. And that, I'm going to stop there and hand you back the mic, Deborah, T1B 18B N12. Here you go.
N12, by the way, about the flat feet, this is a slang term for policemen or the guardians of law and order. This was used first before the it has no arches bit. Correct to read. B19. Miracles rest on the law and order of eternity, not of time. 19-N1. So we've got a bit of notes here. As long as you take accurate notes, every word is meaningful, but you can't always get through. I can't always get through. Whenever possible, I will correct retroactively. Be sure to note all later corrections. This means that you are more receptive than you were when I tried before. Here's the mic, Doug.
Yeah. So what we're seeing here is dictated corrections. And the first is about the flat feet, because previously we had a miracle principle about flat feet. And Jesus is saying that should be corrected to say miracles rest on the law and order of eternity, not on time. That correction, I believe, was made. And then we get into what I think is an enormously significant paragraph. As long as you take accurate notes, every word is meaningful. Jesus is clearly stating here that every word is meaningful. Elsewhere, he repeats this in different words, this theme, suggesting that every word was carefully chosen, and by implication, if it's meaningful and carefully chosen, shouldn't be changed. There's a reason why he chose this word rather than that word. But there's also the implication here that if you're not taking accurate notes, then every word is not meaningful because it's not really his words. It's words from somewhere else. And then he goes on to explain that he can't always get through, and wherever possible, I will correct retroactively. And I think that that is also hugely significant, that he's saying that if there's mistakes, he will be aware of them, and he will attempt to correct retroactively. Later on, he expands that theme by saying, but you must ask. The correction can only take place if you ask for it. Otherwise, by logical inference, it won't. And he then reinforces that by saying, be sure to note all later corrections. And that means, if there's a correction, you're more receptive at that point than you were when he tried before. So we go on now to some stuff that, well, one line that did make it into the air text, and a further lengthy discussion that is only in the notes. A numerical principle here that was copied into the Ur text. Miracles are an industrial necessity. Industry depends on cooperation, and cooperation depends on miracles. And that is a correction of T1B22K. Wait a minute. T1B22K? Oh, no, that footnote is just indicating that this miracle principle was subsequently modified again later on. We'll get to that later. And now an explanation of the flat feet. So this would be T1B20N1. Take it away, Deborah.
Miracles rest on flat feet. They have no arches. Bill will be better on this than you. He'd better be. I don't get it at all, and I am very suspicious about it too. And I am very suspicious about of it too. Bill, did communication break down, or does this mean something? Clue, it has something to do with, here I am, Lord. Bill knows. God, I hope I didn't chop that up too much there. And two, the idea is that I don't want to emphasize your specific language too much. Some of it has to be in his. My own associations here are very bad. A Rorschach response of footprints to the top red on two. No, it's all right. It's the arch of time. There isn't any. So it means miracles do not rest on the arch of time, but on eternity. I must say this is the hard way, and I'm sure this could have been done more directly. I don't see why I should get a message in this way that makes me miss the point and then have to go into mental coma to get it. Here you go, Doug.
This is another section that reads very difficult, partly because it was taken down largely in point form. I think what's happening here is that Jesus was making a pun for Bill in terms of flat feet, which means fallen arches, with an association with the arch of time, which doesn't exist, so there isn't any. And Helen is completely confused. She doesn't get the pun at all. It was directed for Bill, which is why sometimes I want to use Bill's language as well as yours. And Helen is complaining that there's got to be an easier way than telling me stuff I don't understand at all. And like, why should I get a message in a way that makes me miss the point and then have to go into a mental coma to get it? I'm not quite sure what she means by mental coma there, but on to what's going on here is that principle is being revised in these paragraphs, and ultimately the revision was made, and Jesus is giving Helen the the explanation. Helen is complaining about the way he's doing it, but eventually it gets unscrambled. So this brings us to T1B 20 and 3. Deborah.
I'm curious to the connection of what you've written here on the board, Lee. Do you want to take the mic and share so I can get what this is? I don't get it.
Sure. Hi, everybody. I just recognized in reading this that we've just gone over about human birth, maturation, and development being being something that instills in souls the experience of what it is to father, what it is to father creatively, and that what we can see from that one paragraph 231, which corresponds with that paragraph in what we're reading right now, that paragraph states that sex was an aid to the artist and also procreation, an aid to the artist referring to the soul, in his own creative endeavors as he made through sex and through procreation new homes for souls, and then as a father to those children, guide them through the period of their own developmental readiness. That brings each of us into a direct experience of what it is to be the father, and a better recognition of what it is then to come to our own understanding of our relationship to the father as our creator. And then he explains that whole process of procreation is set up as a learning experience, therefore, in teaching us what it is to experience grace in a more full way. So I just find that very similar to this other paragraph that I quoted, that we just read. Being human birth, maturation, and development is that same kind of microcosmic representation of a much larger process of creation and development of abilities. And then he brings it around in the very first sentence of the next paragraph to this sense of parenting again. So, just a quick note.
Doug, did you have anything to add in here? That was really cool, Lee. I really appreciate that. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, Lee, I really appreciate it too. Thank you. That does tie in with B40, which we'll be getting to, oh, probably not today, but soon, yeah. The idea there that we're talking about, I think Jesus is stressing the role of parenthood, fatherhood, and procreation, just as you described. Yeah, that was brilliant. Thank you. And where are we here? We're on Miracles Rest on Flat Feet, T1B 20 and 1. Deborah.
N1. I thought we were starting N3 here. Yeah, we are. We're starting N3. Answer. You've been doing that all along. You have not even bothered to look at the others, which are very clearly stated. I just thought I'd give you this one in a way you couldn't overlook it. It's an example of the shock effect sometimes useful in teaching students who won't listen. It compels attention. And remember to thank Bill for me for his consistent, all-out support. I need it now because you won't listen to anything. But don't worry, the three of us will make it. We're nowhere near the final. By the way, this is an example of the point on cooperation, and don't underestimate your cooperation either. You don't listen and would save yourself a lot of pain if you did, but you did get Chip over his misperceptions of Wally with very credible integrity. N4. This is T1B20, N4. Insert. So I got quite upset and snapped very unfairly at Jonathan, but when I reread, then it went on. N5. So I said, suddenly a little timid and very surprised, "You mean you think I'm nice?" and burst into tears. And he said he must think so, really, because he keeps giving me everything, and he's not angry because I keep on rejecting him, but he's sorry because I suffer so much for no reason. He was really very nice about it. I told him I really do love him, but I have trouble about it, though I did mean it for a little while anyway, before I got embarrassed. And he said he understood very well and would keep on trying. Wow, Helen. NB. Bill, please don't let me down. This is very unexpected. I don't talk this way to men. 40B1. True. T1B21A. Miracles are cobwebs of iron. They unite human frailty to the strength of God. See page 7. T1B21B. Ad for 21. Helen Schuckman considered changing iron to steel. Correction. No, steel would not be a better word. Steel is very useful, but it would have to be tempered by fire. Iron is the raw material. The point of miracles is that they replace fire, thus making it unnecessary. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, that's C page 7. The footnote points us to T1B22E, which is page 7 of the Urtex manuscript, where this, that's a long way down, the cobwebs of iron notion is corrected. And we'll get to that later. That segment is basically totally redictated subsequently. Okay, that's what I wanted to say about that one. Back to you, Deborah.
T1B22A. Miracles are natural expressions of total forgiveness. Through miracles, man accepts God's forgiveness by extending it to others. The second step is inherent in the first, because light cannot tolerate darkness. Light dispels darkness automatically by definition. 22b. Explanatory instructions. Miracles are associated with fear only because of the fallacy that darkness can hide. Man believes that what he cannot see does not exist, and his physical eyes cannot see in the dark. This is a very primitive solution and has led to a denial of the spiritual eye, which always depends on light. Remember the Bible injunction, "May I never forget that thine eye is ever upon me, beholding the evil and the good." Uh, 22C. There are two stages, one lower and one higher, which are involved in the escape from darkness. One, the recognition that darkness cannot hide. This usually does entail fear. 22D. Two, the recognition that there is nothing you want to hide, even if you could. This brings escape from fear. Here you go, Doug.
Well, we're back into our teaching about fear here. And you'll note, if you're following along in the online version, that I've inserted into this copy the foundation section titles, where roughly where they occur. The foundation material is massively reorganized in this section, but this particular passage is the same as the text 1, section 4, Escape from Darkness. So there's two stages here to dealing with fear, or the escape from darkness. One, the recognition that darkness cannot hide, and that usually entails fear. And then two, the recognition that there's nothing you want to hide, even if you could. And that is the escape from fear. Okay, so first of all, darkness or issues that need healing or forgiveness cannot really hide. We can think it can hide, we can deny it, we can put our heads in the sand, but it cannot really hide. And of course, the reason we want to hide it is because we're afraid of it, and the realization that we can't makes us even more afraid. And the cure for that is the recognition that we don't really want to hide it. We want it healed. We don't want to pretend it's not there. We want the problem solved. We don't want to be the ostrich and put our heads in the sand and not look at it because we're scared of it. We want it solved. Now, that, at this point, we move into another long segment from the notes, which includes some very interesting material. T1B22DN1, page 17, Lee, Jesus, Murphy. All the work I went to put on legible references, and you want to use page numbers, which are essentially useless. Okay, Deborah, T1B22DN1, take it away.
I really like this paragraph. This is really, really important to me, as I'm sure it is to everyone. The reason I direct everything that is unimportant is because it is no way to waste your free will. If you insist on doing the trivial your way, you waste too much time and will on it. Will cannot be free if it is tied up in trivia. It never gets out. That's really, really amazing. Wow. And two, I will tell exactly what to do in connection with everything that doesn't matter. This is not an area where choice should be invested. There is better use of time. So now I have to decide on what doesn't matter and what matters. What's trivial, what's not trivial. And three, you have to remember to ask me to take charge of all minutiae, and they will be taken care of so well and so quickly that you cannot bog down in them. And four, the only remaining problem is that you will be unwilling to ask because you are afraid not to be bogged down. Don't let this hold us back. If you will ask, I will arrange these things even if you are not too enthusiastic. Do you think that he's talking mainly to Helen here about, or do you think he's actually talking to the scope of us? I get the impression it's talking to us, period, because we're all saving time. I'm opening the mic here. Doug, do you have anything to say on it? Anybody?
Well, generally, what's being dealt with is a specific issue that Helen is having. Helen is a human being. I'm a human being. You're a human being. We tend to have the same issues she had. The lesson here is about Christ's guidance and Christ's control. The difference isn't really being gone into here. But of crucial importance is there in 22DN1. The reason I direct everything that is unimportant is because it's no way to waste your free will. That applies to me as much as it applies to Helen, I believe. And if you, Doug, insist on doing the trivial your way, you waste too much time and will on it. Will cannot be free if it's tied up in trivia. It never gets out. And then he goes on to say, I will tell you exactly what to do in connection with everything that doesn't matter. that is not an area where choice should be invested. There is better use of time. So you have to remember to ask me to take charge of all minutiae, and they will be taken care of so well and so quickly that you cannot bog down in them. So we have here this distinction being made between the stuff that doesn't matter, where we don't need to invest our will, and an example is given later, I believe, I don't think we've come across it yet, where Helen needs a new winter coat. And this is not a decision that matters. This is something that doesn't matter. It's minutiae. As long as she gets a coat that works, doesn't matter where she gets it. And we talk, we will run into the celestial shopping service. Jesus can help her find exactly the coat she needs at exactly the price she wants. And while doing it, incidentally, the salesman who sells it to her, I believe, is a gentleman with an autistic child, and Helen was uniquely qualified to help that guy get appropriate professional help for his child. So Jesus' orchestration of the things that don't matter produce miraculous results. Not only does Helen save time, she doesn't have to invest a lot of effort in figuring out where and how to buy a coat that's taken care of. It's something that doesn't matter. And the salesman's child is taken care of through her ability as well, one of the children that Jesus wants Helen to help. So this is all orchestrated divinely. But again, we have this, so yes, I think it's absolutely universally applicable to any human being. And again, we have this injunction, you have to remember to ask me to take charge of all minutiae. And they will be taken care of so well and so quickly that you cannot bog down in them. The only remaining problem is that you will be unwilling to ask because you are afraid not to be bogged down. And, I mean, there's so much psychological significance in that that may or may not, well, probably does relate to some of us, that little details in life can absorb our attention because they're a way of escaping from the issues we should be investing our will into. We get bogged down in trivia, so we don't pay attention to the important stuff. And we're being advised here, don't let this hold us back. If you will ask, I will arrange these things, even if you're not too enthusiastic. And then he goes on, prayer can safely be very specific in little matters. If you need a coat, ask me where to find one. I know your taste well, and I also know where the coat is that you would eventually buy anyway. And I mean, this applies, again, to all of us with any trivial daily chore or responsibility that we need to apply ourselves to. Obtaining a coat, obtaining a bag of oranges, I mean, whatever might be required. And I'm going to give the mic back to you on that one, Deborah. And that leaves, I think that was T1B22DN6, I think. And now we are getting it. This is the instance of the Celestial Shopping Service, yeah. This is that.
Okay, you dropped the mic, so I'll pick it up here. I think I'm starting at N5. I think I am, so I'll start there anyways. But I notice that I have the sense of me digging my heels in when I think about asking for this guidance on everything. I'm going, whoa, I feel like I'm just wasting, I'm being a nuisance, or, man, Deborah, just do it. But I also have lots of the experience where things show up where I don't expect them. Exactly what I have been desiring. And I know I've had the thought, I've been aware of thinking it at the time, I would like, or blah blah, you know. But I notice that I'm digging my heels in here, so I think I'm going to maybe take it as an opportunity to take a look at myself and where I'm not actually asking for guidance. In my days where I'm just it's not part of me. So if I start to do it on everything, then I'm going to be moving along with this on more understanding, I guess, and more movement. You think Jesus doesn't have enough time. I get the concept of Jesus dealing with everybody, right? We're all so messed up. I'm going to read what Doug has posted here. Lead paragraph references allow for quick and precise lookup. Page references do not. Everything I do is referenced by paragraph, and I have no conversion charts to page numbers. So I guess that will probably clarify that for you, Lee. I'm going to start here at N5. Prayer can safely be very specific in little matters. If you need a coat, ask me where to find one. I know your taste well, and I also know where the coat is that you would eventually buy anyway. N6. If you don't like the coat afterwards, that is what would have happened anyway. I did not pick out the coat for you. You said you wanted something warm, inexpensive, and capable of taking rough wear. I told you you could get a Borgana, but I let you get a better one because the furrier needed you. N7. Note, however, that it is better in terms of the criteria you established. I could do this because you saw the coat more that way than in terms of a particular material. You thought of Klein's yourself a few days ago, and then you decided against it, because Borgana is price fixed. Then you remembered a coat Grace once got there that was much cheaper and seemed pretty much the same, and asked yourself whether it was really right to be sold on a particular trade name through advertising. That opened your mind. N8. I cannot save you more time than you will let me. But if you are willing to try the higher shopping service, which also covers all lower order necessities and even quite a number of whims within reason, I have very good use for the time we could save. N9. Remember, the specific answer you get depends on the specific question you ask. The fewer limits you impose, the better the answer you'll get. For example, you could ask where I can find a Borgana coat, or where is the coat I want, or where is the coat I should get, and so on. This is so sweet. Here you go, Doug.
Well, I just want to comment on your comment before you began reading that segment about feeling awkward about the idea of pestering Jesus with silly, trivial requests, or what you perceive as silly, trivial requests. And this little segment, which occurs in the notes and was not preserved in any other, any later version, really says, if you take it at face value, that Jesus or the Holy Spirit, however you want to understand cosmic guidance or divine guidance, isn't pestered by trivial requests. In eternity, there is no shortage of time. He does have time for your issues and mine. And he's very, very specifically telling Helen here, and I think by extension all of us, to ask about everything that's not important. All these trivial little things are not what he wants us spending our time and will on. The issues where we need to invest will are the significant questions in our lives, not where to buy the coat. But perhaps how to forgive a brother. That's where we need to learn will and invest will. And we can busy ourselves with the trivial. What color paint should I put on the wall? What color phone should I buy today to go with the paint on the wall? And what color carpet matches with it? We can invest our lives in decisions at that level. And that is a complete waste of will. That's what we're being told. That these unimportant things, we're being told, quite frankly, quite bluntly, ask. Ask. And that issue, that non-important issue, will be resolved effortlessly and quickly and with maximal effectiveness. And then in T1B22DN9, remember the specific answer you get depends on the specific question you ask. So the formation of the question in our own mind is really crucial here, because the answer will be to what we ask. And this linkage here is so significant in terms of how the Holy Spirit or Jesus works with us in daily life, here and now, in space and time, in terms of miracle-mindedness, in terms of miraculously intervening to facilitate our healing and growth. And one of the things we need to do, and we are told, I don't know, dozens and dozens and dozens of times, several in the last few pages, you must ask. And what you ask, exactly how you frame the question, is every bit as important as asking, because the answer you get will be limited or determined by the question you ask. And the fewer limits you impose, the better answer you'll get. And there's a couple of examples offered here, but I would offer another kind of example, that when you think you need a car, for instance, you could ask for a car. Where can I find a car? But do you really need a car? Or do you need mobility? Would you, what you think is a need for a car, be perfectly served if a volunteer chauffeur with a limousine turned up in your life who would take you anywhere you wanted to go whenever you wanted to go there? Well, probably it would for some people. So it's not a car you need, it's mobility you need. It's the function that would be served by the thing, not the thing itself. And the more general the question, the fewer limits you impose, in other words, the more general the question, the better the answer you'll get. Because if you limit it to, my need for mobility has to be answered by a bicycle or an automobile or whatever, then the range of possible solutions to your mobility issue is restricted by your own imagination. You are narrowing down the range of possible solutions by the question you ask. So it's also important, I think, whenever we think we have a need in daily life, to think about it in those terms. Do I really need X that my ego is identifying as my need, this object or this thing, or do I need, is what's really going on, is whatever function that thing would serve, is that what I need? Do I need a glass of water, or do I need my thirst quenched? And there's more ways to quench the thirst than a glass of water, for instance. All right, I'm going to stop at that. What I ought to wear, says Deborah, I will make a point to ask the Holy Spirit what I ought to wear and see what happens. I ask myself, so I think. Well, in fact, we get, at one point in here, Jesus specifically addresses that very question with Helen. And there's no question too trivial, no issue too small. I think of the biblical example, God sees the little sparrow fall. Nothing is too trivial for the divine mind to intervene constructively with us if we are open and asking. Nothing is too small. And we are talking here about the level of miracle at the extremely practical, nitty-gritty, even trivial level of day-to-day life. And Jesus will work with us at that level quite happily. In fact, he's telling us here he wants to. He wants to help us with these things so we have more time and effort to put on the things we really need to be doing, where we have real issues of will we need to work on, as opposed to how to find this or that and where to find it. All right, I'm going to give you back the mic. Deborah. Oh, Carmen says, I will ask what to wear a lot. Good for you, Carmen. I didn't even see that one, Deborah. Ah, I'm trying to look at too many things at once. Okay, here's the mic.
So I was sifting this through my life to see where it stands out, and the business I started 30 years ago was already predestined. Either I didn't consciously wasn't aware of what was going on, because everything just fell into place, into a place that I had spotted years before, but didn't know why I spotted this place. That was the aura around it thing. And then when I wanted to move my business to a new location, I remember putting my order in and saying, I want wood floors, I want windows all the way around, I want a big grass area so I can grow gardens, I want a big parking lot, and like all of these things that I wanted, fireplace. Everything came to what I wanted, every single thing, except I didn't own the place. And when I when I was paying all this rent all the time, I remember thinking, oh, why did I leave that one out? That, I should have included that. It probably would have come too. So I guess this is specifically what Jesus is talking about. There was a lot of work I was doing there for spirit and in healing. There was a lot of healing work I was doing in that business. And then the other thing that comes across my mind is that if I'm focusing on what you're saying there, Doug, the forgiveness and the interaction, the communication between our brothers so that we are healing, that healing work is going on, these are my words, not yours, then what I'm noticing is that the trivial things don't, the importance of them starts to drop off for me. I'm not so caught up in them. Well, that happens some, but I'll have to explore that more because there's some other catches in there. So, okay, I'm going to go on to reading more here. N10. The form of the thought determines the level of creation. And that says it's out of sequence or missing page, which upset me very badly. N11. This AM, I remembered two indistinct dreams. N12. 1. Dr. KDB, you and me, walking down beside Squirrel Park, and LCK is telling me that I have done something very poorly and that he thought that they would have to let me go. But he promised me a portfolio for investing. So there's some missing words in there. You were assuring me it would be all right, but I was by no means sure. N13. The Furrier's Boy, Squirrel Park, Mara. That's just a listing of three. N14. 2. This one was about CDP, that's Squirrel Park. Insert here instructions of the dreams, his, but not dwell on it. Bill got the idea last night. This is the first mopping up. N15. Bills and your problems come from false ideas of creation, which have become associated with the body. Heterosexual relationships are therefore terrifying and induce fears of the destruction of the body, which has been overinvested with power. Two steps, both of which must be undone, are often taken to escape from this seeming dilemma. 1. Pretend the other sex does not exist, i.e. lives in darkness. N17. 2. This rarely suffices in the sane, who will still realize that the other sex is there and also that they need them. So instead of giving them autonomy, they try to control them by internalization. This results in psychosexual confusion. N18. The solution is to leave creation to God and know that neither male nor female create as such. Then you can accept the physical facts and eventually make them unnecessary. Denial is a bad way to handle fear. N19. Bill and Review. The male, the teacher, so there's some missing words in there as well. Doug, here's the mic.
Yeah, this is an extremely difficult patch of the shorthand notes with some illegible bits and one page that ends mid-sentence and the next page doesn't continue it, which suggests a missing page or pages out of sequence. And commentary on dreams. I mean, obviously this material badly needed editing, and I don't think anybody's going to raise an eyebrow that a lot of it got removed. In N15, we have a significant bit of information, though, about the false ideas of creation which have become associated with the body, which makes heterosexual relationships terrifying and induce fears of the destruction of the body which has been over-invested with power. And then two steps, which would be missteps, because they both must be undone, are often taken to escape from this apparent dilemma. One, pretend the other sex does not exist, which would be essentially the homosexual approach. And this rarely suffices in the sane, who will realize that the other sex is there and also that they need them. So instead of giving them autonomy, they can try to control them by internalization. And I'm not sure exactly what that means. A psychologist probably would be. And this results in psychosexual confusion. And then we're told the solution is to leave creation to God and know that neither male nor female create as such. And ultimately, denial is a bad way to handle fear because it doesn't actually handle it. It just buries it. And then we get into another line that I think is potentially a missing miracle principle. And I'm going to read it here. Miracles depend on timing. This is T1B, 22D, and 20. This is why you shouldn't waste time. Miracles depend on timing. So, to me, that means synchronization. That we have to respond to the miracle impulse at the right moment. If the miracle impulse involves another person, we have to be there at the instant that person is receptive, and the Holy Spirit will prompt us at that instant, and the timing is crucial. Which is why we shouldn't be wasting time on trivia, because then we're not available for those promptings. I told you a while back that time would cease when it was no longer useful as a learning aid. There is a way of speeding this up, and that is by leaving more and more time for me, so you can devote it to miracles. And that relates to T1B 1315. That we're told that time would cease when it's no longer useful. So miracles depend on timing. And this very much relates to what we've been reading today. That we need to leave the trivia up to Jesus so that we are available to him for miracles, and we're not spending our time shopping for coats, for example. And now we get into another bit of thick going here. But let's plow through here. Anyway, yeah, to be available all the time. Exactly, Marie. T1B 22D N21, and we're getting another correction and a bit of an explanation. Here you go, Deborah.
This clarifies for me what I've been doing a lot of lately when I've been given the impulses to reach out to someone in a very specific way. And I can feel the energy with it. The energy is definitely that guidance energy, do this. And I stop it. And I say, but as I've been doing this, the outcome isn't the way I think it should have been. So I don't think this is working. I realize that right now fully, that I'm really painting that picture of my expectation of what I think should happen after I do such, even though it's that impulse coming from someplace else, where I'm not sitting down wanting to do something. It just suddenly flies in, here, do this, blah, blah. So I'm going to watch that. So thanks. N21, the first part of what you wrote last night is right. Check this now. Correct it under advice. The second part was put in by you because you didn't like the first. It was an attempt to reestablish your own control over time. Oh, man. I see where my control was in there. This is such an overlap. Remember, you cannot stand not knowing what time it is. I am not intruding on your will, but I am trying to free it. I told you the next part of the course will place increasing emphasis on atonement, and I define this as undoing. You know very well that changing learning patterns requires undoing the old ones, which is incredibly uncomfortable at times, I find. It's very daunting to be going through that process. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, in trying to track down the first part of what you wrote last night and the second part, see exactly what she was referring to, where it says above, apparently out of sequence or missing, I think the first part is what immediately precedes that, and the second part she actually threw out because it was her own, and she recognized it as her own. That's my hunch. I can't entirely be sure, but otherwise I can't find a second part that was put in by you. And in terms of the last night, I'm looking at when she's talking about a dream, that's probably first thing in the morning. What immediately precedes the dream was probably done the night before. That's how I'm gauging sequence here in terms of trying to identify exactly what material is being referred to in this line. But aside from those technical details of unscrambling the manuscript, the issue here, as you've stressed, Deborah, is of crucial importance. And we're moving into a whole new area about undoing and retroactive inhibition, which is actually the process of unlearning, and the whole bit about time, and that asking Jesus to help us save time doing small tasks is not an intrusion on our will, but a freeing of it for what it really needs to be used for. And we're again reminded, you know very well, that changing learning patterns requires undoing the old ones. So this course means that we have to unlearn a lot of things we think we know. And Helen is confronting this very personally with considerable difficulty at this point. And what these notes reveal to us is, to some extent, the precise nature of her difficulty and how gently, persistently, and precisely Jesus advises her on these questions. I mean, it's amazing the extent to which she's freaking out, breaking out into tears, having fits of fear, and Jesus is gently there with her, explaining each one, reminding her and leading her back to the point. And she's able to follow his lead on this, which is itself remarkable. Okay, so this brings us to T1B22DN22, and we've got 10 minutes left, just to remind everybody about that. Okay, here you go, Deb.
N22, the real meaning of retroactive inhibition is simply that when two kinds of learning coexist, they interfere with each other. You were wise in setting up William Radford to allow measuring both the old and new learnings, and thus permitting ratio measurement. N23. Okay, I just got caught on the board there for a second. Actually, I helped you on this one. I am mad about this, because most studies just measure learning decrement caused by new learning over the old, but the emphasis should be on how to minimize the effect of the old on the new. N24. This is much more helpful area to work in. N25. Everything that results in lack of love, which you used to call sin, is a result of inferior learning, which is overlearned, which, if overlearned, becomes very unstable. Everything that results in lack of love, which you used to call sin, is the result of inferior learning, which, if overlearned, becomes very unstable. Doug, here's the mic.
Yeah, what's being stressed here is, as I understand it, the difference between what we think we know, what we have learned in the past, and what Jesus is trying to teach us now. And we have a reference to Helen's professional research in which she is putting the emphasis on how to minimize the effect of the old on the new rather than how to suppress the old in favor of the new. And Jesus is basically congratulating her on that, as I understand it. And is saying that he helped her develop that research focus, that the emphasis should be on how to minimize the effect of the old on the new learning, and telling her this is a much more helpful area to work in. And then, everything that results in a lack of love or sin, what you used to call sin, is the result of inferior learning, which, if overlearned, or if it moves into the habitual, becomes very unstable. And, to go on, because this explains it in a bit of a way, miracles are a way of undoing overlearned patterns or habits of love lack, which could also be referred to by some people as sin. They bring light into darkness. Miracles bring light into darkness, and that is where their atonement value lies. So again, we have this stress on miracles as a way of undoing. And here again, I think we may have a miracle principle that was omitted, because it basically follows the pattern of miracle principle statements. So I'm going to repeat it again because I think it's significant. Miracles are a way of undoing overlearned patterns of love lack. So, bad habits. That's how I interpret that one. Miracles are a way of undoing my bad habits because they bring light into darkness, and that's where their atonement value lies. Through new experiences, and new learning, I think that's what we're being told here, Carmen. Miracles undo old habits through new experiences. And the process involved there is bringing light into darkness, or bringing the darkness to the light, exposing the darkness to the new learning, and minimizing the effect of the darkness on that which we are learning. Okay, so this brings us to T1B22DN27. We've got 5 minutes left. We can get through a couple more paragraphs, maybe. Here you go, Deborah.
This is really great. This is really great. And I like the way you put that, Carmen. Miracles undo old habits through new experiences. And I'm making a commitment to really pay attention more and go with that flow of that miracle mindedness when I'm being instructed, and notice when I'm fearful and let that go. Okay, N27. Do not get bogged down in those dreams of last night. They are reflections of old learning patterns and arose because you did not like what I said about leaving minutia to me. They merely illustrate your unwillingness to get bogged down because you are afraid of the course. So don't use them that way. If you are tempted to do this, ask Bill to stop you. N28. Doug, here's the mic.
Okay, with 3 and a little bit minutes left. I just wanted to summarize for everybody here today what we've actually read and what we've been told in material from the shorthand notes that did not make it into the ear text. And the most crucial part, aside, leaving aside the homosexuality, heterosexuality bit, is that Jesus is asking us to ask him about everything, and that the small details of life, the trivial, the things we consider unimportant, he considers very important, because he can help us very easily with those unimportant things, which saves us from getting bogged down in them and wasting time, which makes us more available for the learning that we are incarnated to do, the areas where our will really does need to be engaged, the choices that are significant to our life direction. And that does not include the choice of where I'm going to buy my winter coat, usually. And this is an area of, I think, enormous significance in practical application in day-to-day, in how we live our lives day-to-day, and how the Course, how Jesus can help us live our lives day-to-day and accomplish the things we came to this earth to do more effectively in less time with less distraction. And because of the omission of this theme in all later versions, I think there's a tremendous amount of confusion amongst many Course students about just how Jesus can help. And it's not just with the big major life issues where guidance can be helpful. He's telling us very clearly here that to free up time to handle those major life issues, he's willing to take care of every little detail. But we must ask, and we must ask with great specificity. Yet, the more general we make the question, the better the answer is going to be, because our answers can limit, our questions can limit the kind of responses that Jesus can make. And I think this is just a tremendously significant little bit of information that is being given to Helen as very personal advice. But I do believe that what applies to Helen and what Jesus is willing to do for Helen, he's willing to do for every one of us. And that this particular teaching is entirely generalizable. And on that note, I'm going to say thank you, everybody, for your contributions and your presence here. I hope this has been of use to you. And I'm going to give you the mic, Deborah, to give your parting comments.
Thanks, everybody. I just wanted to thank everyone for being together here in this healing context in love, in reading this material. Thanks so much, and thanks for radio listeners out there in listening land. Thanks, bye.
Oh yes, and one other thing, this probably has been recorded. I think it's been recorded, and previous sessions are also recorded and on the website at www.miraclesinactionpress.com.